Seabury Resources for Aging is a proud partner of Aging Matters. As a nonprofit, Seabury serves older adults in the Washington, D.C. region and across the United States with its care management model to support caregivers and their loved ones. Seabury is a pioneer in the field of services for older adults, providing affordable housing and support services to help older adults age in place. For more information, visit their website, seaburyresources.org, or call them at 202-289-5690. Hello and welcome to Aging Matters, a program featuring aging-related topics of interest to older adults and their families. I'm Cheryl Beversdorf, your host. Although they experience more health issues, older adult patients often aren't included in research due to age and underlying medical conditions. Including older adults in research can be beneficial because not only do they have different needs for care, but they also have different goals when it comes to treatment. My guest today is Dr. Holly Garriock, Chief Cohort Development Officer with the All of Us Research Program at the National Institutes of Health. She's going to talk about issues that have limited the conduct of research studies involving older adults and what scientists are doing to change that situation. She'll also describe what older adults interested in being included in aging-related research studies should know and do before agreeing to participate. So welcome, Holly, and thank you for joining me today.
Nice to meet you, Cheryl. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Okay, well, Holly, let's get started by having you give us some definitions. When you're talking about research, what is considered older adult? And tell us a little bit more about what I was saying in the introduction. Why are older adults underrepresented in research studies?
So typically, when researchers are doing research on Americans, on individuals that are over the age of 65, that's considered aging research. So that's kind of our older adult population. That age cutoff is usually around 65 or higher. Typically, most health research, most biomedical research in the past has really been done on the people of European ancestries. And our program, the All of Us Research Program, really aims to include that population, the older American population, into the program so that their data can be counted, their data can be seen by the researchers that are doing the research on the program. So to try to address that gap that we have in biomedical research by including their data in the program.
And have you discovered, Holly, that there is a difference between older adults who have participated in research studies and as opposed to those that are living in the real world?
It's possible that there is a difference that exists there. A lot of the participants that will join a research program may go to healthcare centers already. They may be taking quite good care of their health, or they may need some healthcare specifically. And so the populations that we kind of miss out on are those populations that typically have a challenge of accessing healthcare. And so as a program, we make a concerted effort to try to address those needs, address those populations that aren't going to the healthcare centers.
And let's look at this population that we're talking about here. As you've created these studies or would like to create these studies, what are the barriers that come up when you're trying to collect data from older adults and doing these research studies? What do you see?
I'd say there's probably two big barriers that we see. One is that access to healthcare and populations that live in rural areas. And so what we try to do is we have several vehicles that go across the country and we try to really reach communities where they are already. And so we have a mobile engagement asset that travels across the country and tries to go into those rural areas that, regardless of age, you know, informing and raising awareness about the program to those communities that are out there. I would say that the second barrier really is around mistrust, and maybe mistrust of the healthcare system. And this could be for historical reasons, for research that have been done through health systems or the government, and can kind of continue discrimination that they might be seeing. And so how we try to address that barrier and help to engage the communities there with engagement partners across the country that really help us learn from those communities. How do we build that trust with them? How do we build that relationship? And how do we address that barrier of trust and mistrust with the communities to see what they need, see what is valuable to their community, and make them informed about research so that their data can be counted too?
I was also wondering, as an additional possible barrier, might it be technical expertise and knowledge of both getting the word out via an internet or some other, well, the internet would probably be the one that I think of most, but even actual participation, I would imagine that part of it has to do with the internet or sending things over the computer. Might that be a possible barrier as well?
Absolutely. It's so well said, Cheryl. So digital literacy is something that is a big barrier for all of these research programs that are trying to engage participants in a digital way. The All of Us Research Program is a digital program. We do have many partners that help facilitate participation of participants for every step along the way that is in person, kind of helping them navigate how to join on the website, helping them navigate the informed consent process, helping them navigate the surveys that need to be filled out or the biosamples that need to be collected, right? And that's very helpful to many populations, regardless of age. It's just that kind of digital literacy barrier that is a challenge. There's other functionality that the program has taken advantage of. One is computer-assisted telephonic interview, or something we lovingly called CATI. This is where a research staff member is able to call up on the phone a participant of the research study, research program, and talk them through the surveys so that the participant doesn't have to be on their data phone or on the internet. They can really answer questions verbally through their phone to the frontline staff member and get the answers that way. So we try to bridge the digital literacy barrier there as well, using some additional less digital manners way to get participants involved in the program.
And as we start looking at the individuals themselves, this population, I'm wondering whether coexisting chronic health conditions or the fact that the people that you would be doing research with take multiple medications, I'm wondering if that also comes up as too many variables to deal with when considering studies for older adults.
The beauty of the All of Us Research Program is that it collects a massive amount of data. The other beauty is that participants can choose to provide what they want to provide at the pace that they want to provide it. And so for our program, we ask participants to consent to the program, to consent to electronic health record sharing, to agree or disagree to genomic return of results. And then we ask them for responses to surveys. We talk about wearables or Fitbit-like devices, and then biosample collection. And so through the variety of data types that we're collecting, we're getting all of that kind of data that participants can contribute. So what we're able to do is really put all of that data together, that diversity of data, and take advantage of all the experiences that the participant has shared with us, all the data that they've shared with us, and then really look for new preventions, new treatments, new care for participants like themselves.
And if you're really, in terms of research, a particular topic, really trying to zero in on one health condition or one medication, can there be problems in terms of finding outcomes if they're taking too many medications or they've already got heart disease and arthritis and some other condition that may impact the health condition that you're trying to study? Can that be a problem?
Well, what our program will be able to do is tell a participant, based on their genomics, the types of medications and doses that they would be most likely to respond to. That is our kind of medicines and me genetic return of results, our pharmacogenomics. So that's one set of genomic results that participants will be able to see if they, you know, agree to do so. That combined with their health related results, and maybe their ancestry and trait results that they'll get from genomics can be quite helpful, I think. And then it's just up to the participant. If the participant wants to share that data with their healthcare provider, they are 100% free to do so. The program does not share the research data with their provider. So that's really on the participant's control.
I'm wondering also, even just kind of informally, as the interaction between the older adult who's part of the study and the research scientist or the person who's conducting the study, if just kind of the informal feedback, their thoughts about the study or their whatever one they want to share, is that part of the data collection, or is it always very official in terms of what data is collected, that it has to be a specific ways rather than more subjective comments about whether this research might even be necessary or whatever? Just curious as to know about that.
We definitely have a very standardized data collection procedure for the research data that's coming in. So that, I would say, is pretty standardized and pretty strict. In addition, we definitely take information back from participants. So some of the most valuable information that we've received is anecdotal information of what would be valuable to a particular participant or to a particular community. We usually hear that information from our extremely valuable frontline staff that are all across the country engaging with participants day in and day out, every step along the way. And they are the ones that hear that information the most. And so they often bring that back to the program. The program then thinks about a couple different ways to address that concern or that recommendation that the participant provided. Then we kind of bring it back to them and say, hey, what do you think? Does this actually address your need? We have participants that have joined our governance system within the program. And so they are deeply involved in the operations and some of the decision making around the program as well. So participant feedback is invaluable to the program, and we take that feedback directly from participants.
One question I've always wondered about, and I would suspect that our listeners might be too, is if there's studies about a specific medication and we're trying to look at new medications for older adults, might the people who have decided that they're going to participate be concerned if they get placed in the placebo group as opposed to the group that's actually going to receive the medication? And so it would be interesting to hear a little bit more from your perspective how those groups are established and what kind of explanation do you provide to the participants as to which group they might be in and how that's going to work.
It's so important. If a participant is joining a clinical trial like that, that, you know, is very critical to understand what the risks and benefits are of a particular clinical trial. Now, I'll say that the All of Us research program itself is not a clinical trial, not a clinical study. And so we don't do that. We don't divide participants into, you know, particular cases or controls or medications or active arms or placebo arms at all. That doesn't happen. But what we do have is kind of a natural experiment that we're able to execute and allow researchers to investigate. So the participants have agreed to share their electronic health record and fill out all of these surveys on their health and their lifestyle and their experiences. And so what researchers can then see in that data set that participants are providing is whether or not they've been on a particular medication or not. And so researchers, in a data way, can separate participants that have already been on a medication or not, or maybe two different medications, right? Kind of split up the arms of their particular research question and compare them. I would say if any of your listeners are thinking about, you know, joining a clinical trial that does do any of medication type related clinical trials, just to very carefully read the informed consent form. that's really where the risks and benefits are going to be laid out for any research study, especially a clinical trial where they might want to get involved in.
Given the fact that older adults, their lives are different in terms of so many aspects, physical or mental or social or whatever, I was wondering if researchers who decide that they are going to be doing studies that involve older adults, do they get special training or some kind of a tutorial, if you will, as to what to expect in these particular studies? And if so, what does that look like?
Within our program, within the All of Us research program, there's really two populations that I would want to call out here. And one is the frontline staff. And so those frontline staff, as I mentioned before, they're engaging with our participants on the day-to-day, really walking the participant through the protocol and helping the participant share all of their data with the program. Now, they are trained in how to execute the protocol regardless of age, but they do take special considerations for populations. So all of the data from our participants goes into a researcher hub. And in this researcher workbench, that's where the scientists coming in and using that data. They are very well trained in terms of appropriate use of the data and need to sign specific data use agreements, their organization signs a data use resource agreement, and the researcher has to sign a data code of conduct in order to do that. So they're very trained in terms of responsible use of the data.
I was wondering, since we're hoping that there will be more research studies conducted that are involving older adults, how are you going out, or you and your colleagues going out, to educate and seek participation from these older adults? What are you telling them? You mentioned a little bit already about informed consent, but what else? What would they need to know in order to be encouraged to participate?
First, the how we're doing it, right? So we are engaging with our community partners as engagement partners. We are engaging with our healthcare partners to meet the patients of their healthcare center and really trying to go again where their community is. So we have community convenings so that we can learn from that community what is valuable to them and what we can get them in terms of back for the program. When we meet with them, we do definitely tell them about the program, the value of the program. You know, in for a population interested in aging, we may tell them about the importance of being included in aging research, right? So the importance of understanding the biology, the aging biology, that's very important. And one reason why we need to include participants that are 65 and older into the population. We may help tell them about the benefits of the program, right? The genomic health-related return of results, how we may be able to help inform them how their body metabolizes drugs, how the data that they provide is so valuable, not only for researchers, but also for their family. So they may not benefit directly in terms of a medical breakthrough or healthcare advance, but their children may, their grandchildren may, right? And so that is very valuable in terms of overall health longevity that is important for them.
And Holly, I was just wondering, because you have so much good information here, and this program goes throughout the country, is there a certain website that people could log on to? Are there studies besides your program, the All of Us research program, are there other programs just in general connected with the National Institute of Health that people could go, ooh, I'd really like to learn more about this? Might there be a website? And then on that website, is there information that they should know, too, in terms of making their decision?
Our website is www.joinallofus.org, joinallofus.org. And on that website, it really does a thorough job of explaining what the program is about. It walks you through all the different steps that would be required. it tells you the risks and the benefits of it even before you join, so that before you click that join button, you have a good idea of what our program looks like and what our ask is. And our ask really is, you know, a true partnership with the program, participants to partner with the program for 10 years or more. So we are really looking for a longitudinal, ongoing involvement with the participants.
And I'm wondering if researchers are also going to primary care physicians or gerontologists or other health providers that work with older adults and telling them about what they're thinking in terms of studies and ways that also get the word out. Is that a possibility? Is that increasing now, or what do we know?
Yeah, what we know in terms of our involvement with the program, we have some provider champions where those providers have said, man, that All of Us research program really has a lot of promise. And I see the benefit for my patients to become participants, right? So those providers have really become great champions for the program. And that's one of our best ways within the healthcare system to have participants join the program.
And do you reach out then to like the American Academy of Primary Care Physicians or the American Medical Association? How does that work? And so that you get that word out on a, say, national basis?
That's largely through our engagement partners. We have specific federal funding that goes to those groups to help us spread awareness of the program. It may be awareness to join the program. It may be awareness about the research data set. It may be other, you know, just engagement steps to try to learn from them, you know, hey, how do we get your population interested and trusting of the program? So that's how it happens, is through federal awards.
I also wanted to understand a little bit more, and I think listeners too, again, if they're trying to figure out whether they would want to be involved, how do researchers communicate the aspects of the clinical trials in a way that, say, populations that have a lower health literacy or the ones that you mentioned earlier might be mistrustful? How do you convince them that this is a good thing in a way that will say, oh, well, maybe I do want to participate, but recognizing that there might be issues that need to be overcome to get these folks involved?
A lot of patience and relationship building is the main way to do it. You know, some of these communities distrust healthcare for really, really valid reasons. And this is just something we have to acknowledge and partner with them, learn from them what it takes to really build that trust. It's really just informing those communities, informing them of what we are, what are the security standards we have around for the program, you know, how, what are the partners that we have, who has availability to the research, all of the questions, just being able to answer all of those questions in a really open, transparent way is, I think, the only way that anyone that has a mistrust of the program or healthcare might then decide to take the next step. In terms of health literacy, that's definitely a struggle regardless of age. So if you're, you know, we're not a clinical trial, but we do try to convey health-related information to all of our participants. And we try to bridge the digital divide a little bit by sending non-digital information, keeping that constant drumbeat of communication and connection between the participant and the program, I think, is the way to really communicate the value and the commitment that the program has to their community.
I've also seen sometimes, of course, because we're here in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, of course, weekly, the section in the Washington Post is the health and science section. And occasionally I see a reference to some types of clinical studies that people can apply to as well. So I'm assuming that perhaps even in other parts of the country, that a newspaper may also indicate, especially if they have some kind of a health section. Am I correct?
You're absolutely correct. One of the partnerships that we have is with the Veterans Affairs Center. So with the VA, we have a great partnership with them. We had 19 cities activated, enrolling participants across the country with our VA partner. And they took out full-page ads, half-page ads in newspapers that are relevant to their audience, relevant to their community. And they heard it. They saw it. They read it, right? They brought it into their centers. And in terms of aging Americans, that our partnership with the VA is our number one enroller of aging Americans. And so it's a great partnership. Newspaper is a great media for certain communities. And yeah, that is a very successful engagement and communication method that we use.
And there are a lot of VA health centers around the country, so you can conduct these studies in many places as well. So I also wanted to ask another concern that older adults might have, Holly, and that is just an assurance that the ethical standpoint of that they are really assured that the researchers have the apply the necessary scientific concepts and that there is an awareness of participant safety when it comes to these scientific studies. I say that especially because, unfortunately, older adults can be the victims of scam or some kind of fraud. And if they see some kind of an ad, what should there certain concepts or certain items that they should look for there to make sure that this is a legitimate study and that they're not going to be taken by some scammer?
What I would say is really look for what are the characteristics of whatever that ad is representing in terms of security and privacy. I can tell you from our program really does focus on keeping the data secure and private. And so your health data and your identifiable data really are separated. The data is de-identified. The data is stored in very protected computers. It's limited in terms of anybody who can have access to the data and who can see the data. The data is encrypted. And we security test the systems that house our data all the time. So that is a constant. So we try to break into it and breach it and make sure that that's not possible. And when it is, we fix it. The researchers that are found to not be abiding by some of the rules and the code of conduct that they must sign can be held to legal implications as well as financial implications. And so there's a significant impact on researchers that do not abide by the very strict rules and regulations that a registered researcher needs to agree to when they're using our data. So if I was looking at an ad and worried about being scammed, I would ask myself, how is the data being secured? How is the data being kept private? What do the researchers that use the data, what do they have to sign? Let me see the agreement. What are they agreeing to? And if those researchers, you know, do something that they shouldn't do, do stigmatizing research or actually try to identify me as a person, what's the consequence there? I would want to know that as a participant. I would also want to know, you know, how are my biosamples being kept safe? Are they, you know, kind of in a very loosey-goosey kind of warehouse biobank, or are they in a very secure, protected storage lab at the Mayo Clinic, for example, like where are the samples are for our program. So, you know, samples for our participants that share, they do not have our name on it. They are coded with a non-identifiable code. They're really kept secure in that lab. So I would also want to know, hey, where are my samples going to be stored and who's going to have access to them? So, you know, really following up on what are the safeguards to the data, safeguards that the researchers are kept to, safeguards on the biosamples, I think are all things that I would really ask about as I was evaluating legitimacy of a particular ad that I saw in a newspaper or in a flyer that came across my email along those lines.
Holly, you're saying such good things, and certainly you as an experienced researcher yourself know this information already. You know what questions to ask. Needless to say, there are many of us out there, even myself included, that we don't know what we don't know. And so I was wondering if in your experience, as your colleagues look to do these studies, is there sometimes recommended, like a patient advocate? It's not exactly the same. I mean, we think about when we go to the physician, we often take along somebody who can kind of help to interpret and remember what the doctor said and this kind of thing. But in this case, are there people who are experts who are, I don't know, retired or something like that, that could help older adults so that there would be a larger number of folks participating, but at least somebody's there helping them to ask the right questions?
That is a fantastic suggestion. And I think that's something that we probably need to take back to the program and really see how we can make that possible. Right now, we really depend on our participant ambassadors. And those participant ambassadors are all ages, all walks of life, and really, really spreading the news of the program. They're not as focused, as you mentioned, in terms of really a kind of a patient advocate role. But that's a great way. We should really think about how we can do that. We, you know, we try to provide all the information on websites and newsletters and, you know, through all of the ways and channels that we can get to participants. But there's no replacement for that just-in-time information so that a participant can really ask those questions that are important in the moment.
And I'm thinking also, again, to add on to what I was asking you is that if you want to attract more diverse audiences, people who don't speak English or have a different cultural background, they may speak English, but needless to say, when you say a sentence in English, it might be interpreted differently by someone who speaks a different language. I was wondering if not only in terms of knowledge-wise, language-wise, that could also be an added dimension of this so-called advocacy group. Is there an effort already to start thinking about attracting populations that are older, but again, different culturally or language-wise, or what's happening in that regard?
Our program is available in English as well as Spanish. So the entire program, the entire participation pathway is possible in English and Spanish. We have heard loud and clear the need for additional languages in order to get additional communities involved in the program. And so we're trying to figure out the most efficient way to do that. It takes a lot to enroll or to implement the program in a whole nother language. And so we're trying to figure out what is the best way to do that, to authentically engage those communities that are not English or Spanish, make sure that they fully understand what, you know, what they're doing as they join the program and fully understand the questions that they were asking them to complete. So trying to balance that with, you know, really making it true to our all of us statement and being able to enroll them in the program in a really informed way. Diversity is so important. And language is just one part of it, right? And our whole goal really is to make sure that they're included.
And it's interesting because studies that have already been done often indicate that, for example, health conditions might be more likely to affect African Americans as opposed to white people, or Asian people are more likely to get such and such a disease as opposed to Hispanic, and the list goes on. And so including them and figuring out how to successfully include them seems absolutely essential.
So important. And it's so important, I mean, just for older Americans as well, right? There are a certain set of experiences, exposures that aging population has had that the younger population has not yet had. And so how do we take all that data into account and hopefully identify at a really early age a particular risk factor or preventative factor for a health condition, and then be able to learn from that and have that benefit other communities? I mean, ultimately, having that inclusion and having the researchers able to do research on those populations can inform policy. That is one thing that we hope we eventually get there. the program itself is not going to be doing policy. And actually, the program itself doesn't do the research. We just help put together the data set and build the infrastructure possible to collect all of the data. The researchers do the research, and then we're hoping the policymakers will then use data-based, evidence-based data to make policies that will be very helpful to all of the populations, not just the European populations that have historically been included in health research.
Holly, one question, since we were talking again about being properly informed, you did mention a little bit earlier about the informed consent. I was just wondering if that aspect also is something that would require or be encouraged to have, like, an advocate or maybe even an attorney. I mean, do we get to that level that we want to make sure that people know exactly what they're signing up for, as it were? Any general rules or advice that you give to people insofar as informed consent to participate in research studies?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would go quite to the level of an attorney for an informed consent. However, I do think it's very important to understand what you're getting into, and that informed consent document is the document that will provide all of the information available to you about the study. So it'll tell you the risks, it'll tell you the benefits, it'll tell you what's expected of you, how long you're expected to participate. It'll tell you how your data is protected or not, how your samples are protected or not, how your data is going to be used by researchers, what results you might get back or not. So any research study will lay all of this information out in the informed consent. Now, sometimes the informed consent is a piece of paper or a lot of pieces of paper that a participant has to read and then sign the back one, right? Sometimes it's digital. Ours is digital. And so you can see everything on the participant portal as you're joining the program. That once you agree, you can also sign it digitally and then have it printed out for you so that you have the physical form in front of you. We also are very careful to provide some videos to try to make it a little bit more understandable, because it is kind of legalese when you look at the informed consent. You can very quickly get tired and overwhelmed with all of the information that's in there. I fully understand that. And so the videos that are provided for informing participants really pull out the critical information for the program so that participants can have a better understanding, that sometimes a visual understanding as well as an audio understanding of it, so they're not just reading it. And then we, at the end of those videos, we have a little quiz. Did you understand what we were trying to convey? And so that's a good little knowledge check to say, hey, you know, is that informed consent actually make the information over to you the way that we intended it to?
That's very helpful. I wanted to turn now to part of the reason that we're doing this program is to see where your program and similar programs are going. And I was wondering if there's been any federal guidelines that are directing research institutes and programs such as yours, that it's mandatory, given the fact that our population is getting older, that there are more research studies that be conducted that pertain to issues about older adults. And so it's kind of a two-part question. One, are there guidelines that are directing researchers? And if so, are there certain issues or conditions or whatever that you should be studying or researchers should be studying? What's the future look like in this realm?
Yeah, several federal programs, as well as the FDA, the NIH, have really encouraged the need for inclusion of older Americans in research programs so that we can really help understand what aging looks like, what's the biology of aging, how do we increase longevity if that's something that we want to do, and really try to prevent some of the negative health outcomes that people in general want to try to avoid. And so is just a way to identify a gap in participation that research in general has for the aging population. And so we try to make sure we have the right partners in place and be able to get the right community involved to join the program.
And I was wondering specifically, because of course, when you think about older adults, you really do think about health conditions. And I'm wondering if that tends to be a priority. The example, which I'm sure you know already, Molly, is the whole debate about the Alzheimer's drug that was recently approved, and there's folks who like it and who don't, and this kind of thing. But I'm just wondering again if these certain health conditions have already been identified and like this is going to be our top priority now, or are there more that have been studied and need to be looked at in a different way because it was conducted in an earlier time and the population looked different than it does now? So talk a little bit more about how these topics are chosen and what the approach is.
Yeah, the topics are chosen, I'm sure, in a variety of different ways, probably motivated some by where the federal funding is available or, you know, what is particularly important and in someone's mind in the policy-making realm. I will say, in terms of Alzheimer's or cognition, one thing that we have within the program, which we didn't have for a while and has not really been represented in other health research, is brain games. And so part of some of the data that participants can provide when they're joining the program is ongoing kind of cognitive assessments. And so it's very exciting to have four tasks that are available. We worked very closely with the National Institute of Mental Health to get these tasks integrated into the program and available to our participants. And so our participants can answer these or play these games. They're providing data. They're not just playing games. Play these games. They provide the data with us over and over again, which gives us some indication of potential early signs of cognitive decline, attention-related issues, reward-related concerns that we might see. So these cognitive behavioral tasks or these brain games that are available to participants is just one way that we're able to engage with participants and generate data that really wasn't available in early days. And now that aging participants are much smarter, much more digitally savvy than they were in the past, they're able to complete these games on the digital platform and provide this data. And I have no doubt, again, that this is really going to help researchers develop medical breakthroughs or at least preventative factors, biorisk factors around cognition and brain health in general.
I was also wondering, too, again, in terms of the human condition, and that's why I mentioned about earlier studies, people are living longer. I mean, I always say my parents died at age 76 back in 1980 and 1992. And now when you hear about folks are living to be in their 90s and even older than that, are there studies being focused on what are the factors? I mean, and I would assume it's not only just the health condition, but is it the physical condition? Is it diet? Is it exercise? Is it the sociability? Is there some thoughts about those aspects as well as to try to figure out and not only figure out why people are living longer, but how we can continue that? Is that a focus?
100%. So what we're doing is really putting this data set together around precision medicine. And what that does is really takes into account all of those variables that you just mentioned. So lifestyle factors, biological factors. So looking at what your exposure, your environmental exposures were, what your social exposures are or were in the past. What's your biology like now? What's your health like now? Taking all of those variables into account. What's your isolation like? What's your discrimination exposure, right? These social determinants of health that can be so impactful. Sometimes your zip code can be more impactful than your genomic code. And this data is definitely something that researchers take into consideration when they're asking these questions about risk factors for health outcomes. So all of that is very important for the researchers, which is why it's important we need a diversity of participants around, right? So we need a diversity of participants that have lived in the tropics or had unique exposures, had different family structures, right? It's not just genomics, it's exposure, it's environmental as well. We need all of that information in order to really drive to a precision medicine, really tailored health outcome.
I'm thinking also too, I mean, oftentimes when I produce this show on aging matters and people say, well, who's your audience? Well, we're talking about everyone from age 55 to age 100. And so when you're talking about the different aging or older adult populations, you do have different needs. Some older adults are still working full time. Others are retired, but they're doing other kinds of things. I'm wondering if within this older adult population we're talking about, there's even a reference to age-specific guidelines. Because if you're talking about, I'm thinking, people who are in their 50s and 60s are still pretty active, whereas if they're around 90, are we worried as much about, or do we think about their attitudes toward death? And not living or not having that other surgery or whatever. Are we getting to that level yet in terms of research for older adults because we're facing these possibilities, or aren't we that far yet in terms of focus?
You know, I think you just made an amazing suggestion of a survey that we need to add to the program around, you know, beliefs and understanding around death and everything that you just mentioned. That does not exist right now within the program, but it's a really valid point. And that is a stressor, right? The death is a stressor. Maybe fear of death is a stressor, and the amount of which we make that into stress can be variable, and the way we ingest it can have, you know, negative or positive health outcomes. And knowing how individuals see stressors? Do they see it as a stressor? Is it actually stress, right? What is that mindset for participants? And does that impact their health positively or negatively and their longevity? We don't know. We don't know the answer to that. We don't have that data being collected currently. It's a fantastic suggestion.
And I think one of the things is that if you're a researcher that's in his or her 40s or 50s, you're not thinking about death the way people are who are in their 80s and 90s. And so I think the whole concept of elderhood, and I know there have been books written about elderhood and what that means, and the attitudes of maybe, at least for physicians, that it's not necessarily the goal to heal that person, but to make that person comfortable and to deal with some of those issues. And I think it must be difficult, I would suspect, to craft research studies that get into these details because everybody's attitude is different. I mean, and you hear that in terms of families of keeping a loved one alive versus letting them go. And it's different between the person themselves plus the family members. A lot of nuances here I'm throwing at you, but I'm just wondering how those things can be handled in a research arena.
One of the beauties of the program is that once you participate in the All of Us Research Program, it opens doors for what we refer to ancillary studies. So these are additional research programs that you can participate in at your interest and eligibility as a function of being an All of Us Research Program participant. And so, for example, one of the ones that we have right now is Nutrition for Precision Health. So trying to figure out what's the best diet for a particular person to have optimal health, if we kind of generalize things, right? You can imagine this varies over time and varies over age. And so that's why if we don't have, you know, an older population or variety of ages included in Nutrition for Precision Health, that we won't learn information then for that population that will really inform, you know, what's the most optimal way to decrease the inflammation in my overall system using food as medicine. So really, it's kind of getting into the research program opens the door for these additional research studies that may be interested to other participants may be interested in. So whether it's nutrition for precision health or, you know, beliefs and understandings around death or longevity, family support, you know, whatever is the condition, we're having in continual evolution of what those additional studies are. You could imagine another study around eye health, right? And how our eyes change over time and how, you know, just getting a bunch of 50-year-olds, it will give you one set of data for sure around eye health, but getting that kind of longitudinal exposure, kind of broad cross-sectional assessment across ages of eye health, and then looking at all of the diversity of data types that those participants have shared with us from genomics through environment, that's really where the value is. And that's where we're really going to see the medical breakthroughs come through.
And you're also dealing with the fact that there are practitioners out there who believe that maybe some other kind of integrative health factors might be more like herbal therapy or some other acupuncture and those kinds of treatments as opposed to the more traditional healthcare model of medications. And are there studies that are focused on this to perhaps do some comparison as to which is more effective, both on a short-term basis and a long-term basis?
You know, that's a great question. I think there are, over 37 research questions being asked around aging health using the All of Us research program. If we were to look in our researcher workbench, and so that's a fair amount. I don't know all the various topics that those research questions are on. I will say that, you know, participants agree to share their electronic health record, which has a lot of their health data from their healthcare system included in it. And we ask them for survey responses, which includes a lot of the things that we're not going to get from their EHR. And so that's really where we would capture some of that alternative healthcare supplements and approaches that you were mentioning. So again, it's really that combination of self-reported information from surveys plus the healthcare center electronic healthcare record with their genomics that's really going to kind of help us triangulate to the value of the research on the diverse data set.
One question that I would be remiss if I didn't ask, because interestingly, there was a recent article in the Washington Post about this very issue, that amongst older adults, there tends to traditionally be more studies that affect men rather than women. And I cite specifically heart disease, a major issue that has been with us. And of course, we all know that heart disease is the number one killer of people, and it affects women as well as men in different fashions in terms of symptoms and this sort of thing. What are your thoughts in that? Is that changing? Are there more studies being developed to address this issue? Why was it that way in the past? Tell us more about that issue.
It is an issue that is near and dear to my heart, you know, pun intended here, but it is very important. I think, you know, heart disease in women is very understudied, not well understood. We're pretty tough cookies, us women, and often don't take seriously maybe some of the symptoms that we have. And maybe there's more variability among women in this particular condition, but really there's not a lot of data. And so it's because of that historical nature that has happened where research has really focused on men. The advances that have happened, the pharmaceuticals that work, the surgical approaches were tailored towards men. There is some changes now, some advancements in it. It's been several years now where inclusion of women and children in research studies has really been mandated and really encouraged by the federal government. And, you know, I think we're not quite there yet in terms of what that means, or what it means for the public to adopt the findings of the research studies. We're not quite there, but we're getting close. And I think it's just important that the women continue to participate. They continue to get their family members involved, their moms, their sisters, you know, their aunts, their even, you know, everybody else in their family. We still need the men to be included. But I think it's just this constant, persistent grittiness of women that we need to be represented in general, but in research in specific.
And I think the thing that's interesting about that is as I said, I repeat about heart disease being the number one killer, and yet women tend to live longer for the most part than men. So what's that about in terms of longevity? Is it because of particular illnesses, or is it lifestyle, or is it hormones, or what are the issues that determine, or maybe it's more mental attitudes that play a role? But I was just curious, and we're getting close to the end here. So, but I just thought if you had any thoughts as to, again, since we're talking about aging and older adults, whether that's going to be talked about or researched in the future.
I think it's a great thing to research, and it's a great thing that researchers can use our data set in order to answer some of those questions around longevity. What it is that, what's the magic that keeps individuals alive longer? Not quite sure, and I'm sure it varies from community to community. But I really look forward to the promise of the data and the researchers asking those important questions of our data to get those answers, because I want to live a long time.
So, Holly, any of the resources that you mentioned that you'd like to just reiterate again, and any final comments that you'd like to share?
Yeah, resources for sure. So if you're interested in learning more about the program or even joining the program, you can go to www.joinallofus.org, all one word. If you want to look at some of our research data, kind of in the aggregate population level, you can go to researchallofus.org. And that provides some data snapshots around participants that have already joined, as well as some of the data types and variables and the demographics of the population that exists so far. You know, I think the only last thing I'll say is I can't think of something more valuable to leave behind in terms of, you know, family members leaving their legacy and really helping future generations. So, you know, share your data with the program. It will, if it doesn't directly help you in terms of medical breakthroughs, you'll get some return of information, some return of value, return of genomic information to help inform some of your healthcare decisions moving forward. And, you know, the family members that you leave behind most likely have the potential to benefit from the data that you've provided, given what the researchers will be able to do. So I think it's a pretty great legacy to leave behind if your participants are thinking along those lines.
Good advice. And I certainly want to thank Dr. Holly Garriock, who is the Chief Cohort Development Officer with the All of Us Research Program at the National Institutes of Health. Thank you so much for joining me today, Holly. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Cheryl.
And I just wanted to mention and remind listeners that if you'd like to learn more about Aging Matters, you can visit our website, which is agingmattersonline.com. And of course, at that site, you can access all of the Aging Matters radio programs that we've produced, also the TV show episodes, and the podcasts, which are now posted on Apple, Spotify, and Red Circle. So again, agingmattersonline.com. Also, want you to know that Aging Matters is produced in association with Steve Lack Audio. To learn more about that company, you can log on to stevelackaudio.com. Thank you for listening to Aging Matters today. And remember, age is just a number, not a label. I'll be back again with you next week. Seabury Resources for Aging is a proud partner of Aging Matters. As a nonprofit, Seabury serves older adults in the Washington, D.C. region and across the United States with its care management model to support caregivers and their loved ones. Seabury is a pioneer in the field of services for older adults, providing affordable housing and support services to help older adults age in place. For more information, visit their website, seaburyresources.org, or call them at 202-289-5690.